This is the Linksys for Me Too podcast series with Gregor Ross and Andy Wallace.
Okay, welcome to the From Me Too podcast. Delighted to be here with Ross Hunter from CopyLab. Ross is the founder and executive chairman of CopyLab. They're an investment communications company, content creator. And Ross is also a Forbes Council's member and also Global Scott LinkedIn influencer, which we'll hear a bit more about. And also about to work with Linksys as one of our partners. So we're excited about that journey, Ross. So just to give you a bit of a brief, the From Me to SME, I suppose in your case, is really to get to understand our guests a bit more, where they've come from, what fuels their desire to have become the entrepreneurs that they have, and just learn a bit more about their journey and where you're heading in the future. So is that all right yourself, Ross?
Sounds good. It's a great introduction, Andy.
Yeah, I know.
Great to meet you, and great to meet you, Gregor, too.
Yeah.
Cheers, Ross. Looking forward to the chat. Do you just want to just very quickly go over the CopyLab role and where you are at the moment?
Sure. Well, CopyLab, it's a company I founded in 2005. I'd worked in-house for big financials for 10 years before that, and so launched CopyLab as an outsourced content marketing agency, specifically financial services companies. So mainly investment managers in the UK, in Europe, North America, and Asia, and more recently for wealth managers in North America.
Great. So now we know where you are. Can we go right back to the start? We always do this. Can you talk about your upbringing?
Yeah, well, I went to school in Edinburgh, but I was actually born across the border in Berwick-upon-Tweed. So technically speaking, I'm English. So don't hold that against me.
Not at all.
Yeah, I went to school in Edinburgh, went to university in Stirling, so just a few miles up the road. And studied marketing there. So that was really where I got a passion for, you know, growing businesses and communications as well.
And did you enjoy the education side of things?
I suppose I did, actually. At school, I was really into English. That was my favorite subject. And I was a pretty good writer, I guess, thinking back, although I didn't really realize it at the time. And my mom encouraged me into that. She was a teacher. So she was encouraging, quite assertively, I would say, and made sure I did my homework. But I really enjoyed doing English and being a creative writer. So maybe that's where that came from.
So what made you want to go and study? Was it Stirling University of Marketing? What was the thought behind that?
I had no idea what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I went to a university where you could be flexible on the course. Started off doing politics, economics, and French. I dropped French after 6 weeks. I dropped politics at the end of the first year, and I was doing business studies by the middle of second year. And then very quickly found that marketing was the element of business studies that I really loved. I really enjoyed that part of the course.
Yeah, you mentioned quite a few blue chips there, so I'll reel some off there. You worked for Prudential, Baillie Gifford, Standard Life Investments. You know, tell us about your time at these companies and how that's possibly shaped your career leading up to CopyLab.
It's a good question. Really, I never, like I said, I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Yeah.
I still don't, you might say. But my first job out of uni, I was very lucky to be hired by Scottish Amicable, which was like a Stirling-based insurance company, as a trainee copywriter. So that was the opportunity to, you know, use my writing skills, but also learn about insurance products. Very exciting things to update 32-page pension guides for customers here. And that really got me into a real small niche in the industry of being able to understand technical content and communicate in a way that's useful and engaging for customers. And that led on from Scottish Amicable got taken over by Prudential. After a few years. And I moved into the investment industry with Baillie Gifford and then Standard Life Investments. So I got that sort of insurance plus investment management subject matter expertise, so that having done 10 years of that, I felt in a good position to go it alone.
And then, so you went alone? yep. freelancer,
mm-hmm.
lifestyle business.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did that move into ending up being popular?
Yeah, it was. It was 2005. We were just about to start a family. Found out we were expecting in November, and in the May, decided, well, it's going to be now or never, really. I need to jump ship if I'm going to do this at a relatively low-risk time in life before the financial requirements of kids become more of an issue. So went freelance for the first couple of years. It was really quite straightforward. Worked from home, helped Luke bring up my son, who's going to be 20 in a few months' time, which I can't quite believe. And then the business just grew organically over those next 5 years. I wasn't really trying to grow a business at that point. I was trying to live a more work-life balance type of arrangement. Mm-hmm. And that worked pretty well until it didn't. And then, yeah.
I mean, this is something the other entrepreneurs that we've spoken to talk about, the commitment when you start something on your own.
Yeah.
The freelance work, did you find a switch between that and the what was required input from the when you then started CopyLab? Or was it from the off?
Well, I kind of branded myself as CopyLab from early on, actually.
Right.
So maybe I did have this in mind about creating something in the future. But it was probably after about 5 years when Oliver started school, Marissa was getting a bit older and was in nursery. And I was starting to pick up clients and getting introductions to other clients, finding I was actually having to subcontract work out to other people. And a time came when I realized, actually, I need to make a decision here. Do I turn away work, or do I actually employ people and start to build something? Life is interesting enough. Let's go for it. The kids are going to be going into school. I want to explore growing this into a proper business, and that's how CopyLab really got going in probably 2010, 2011.
And I'm thinking about our relationship, co-founders, so you have that support right away. Was it scary at all, starting off yourself?
It didn't feel that way. Because I wasn't really thinking about growing something into a particular size. I had picked up a couple of clients quite early on, so I felt comfortable. It was kind of a good base. And, being a services business, there's very little capital outlay. It's just a laptop, an internet connection, could work from home. So that was pretty easy. So less risk and no partner to answer to either.
Yeah.
So when you're setting up CopyLab, when did you first move into an office? Because I believe you moved into a merchant.
That's true.
City. And another sort of slant on that is, why, if the financial sector is primarily in Edinburgh, what was the sway to Glasgow?
Yeah.
As a base.
Good question. When I first the first person that joined me in the business was Stuart, who was in London. He was a commercial director. We'd been friends for a few years. I knew him, and he joined to really build a business down there. Mm-hmm. That's where most of our customers are based. They were, there's obviously a big financial services community in Edinburgh and Glasgow, but London is the main part for financials in the UK. So he did a really good job quite quickly, which meant I needed to pivot from being the writer to being more of the managing director, or in the early days, it was more the operations director how do I find the people to staff the new projects that Stuart's bringing on? So that really led to, I need to hire someone and we need to have somewhere to work. And so the first person I hired was Paul. Paul lived in Glasgow and I lived closer to Glasgow then. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity. I don't want to become another stuffy firm based in Edinburgh with the grey suits. I want to stand out a little bit from my competitors, and be disruptive psychologically, I think, to the financial services community. So we set up in Glasgow, and we picked an office in in a creative studio, which was really full of artists and us. Mm-hmm. And our floor was like an old gym floor with the stickers still on it from the basketball court. And it was very funky.
Yeah.
It was a great place to be.
Different energy.
Different energy. And really, it suited our, we had a very relaxed and formal style as a culture back then. And to some extent, we still do. But it really helped us just not fall into the old ways of becoming a Me Too sort of financial services type shop.
And did the customers react to that right away, you think? Is that clear to them, the disruptive nature?
Maybe it's hard to say, because clients would never come and see us. We would always go and see them. But I think it was reflected in the way we approached work, and we were conversational, friendly with the clients. We came across as being approachable and more of a creative agency than a professional services agency.
So, started yourself. How many now employed? How many in the team, specialists?
We have around 25 people in the UK, another 6 or 7 overseas, mainly in North America, but also in Asia. And then we have a long freelancer roster. And that sort of fits our operating model quite well. So we have a big team of contractors, freelancers that we bring in for certain projects.
So if you think about that, then how many years is that?
Oh, 20 years.
20 years, probably. So that journey, because I know a lot of people, the feedback we've got from the first podcast already are interested in how leaders have learned from what they went through.
Yeah.
Is that building and scaling? Yeah. Is there any key lesson there that you can share?
The one thing I'm glad we did, or I did, was not to get, not to become an empire builder. And not to hire people for the sake of hiring people. And what I learned very early on was to match the resources to match our costs to our revenues. So whenever we got a contract from a client, it would come in very different shapes and sizes, because as a services business, we're consulting, we're going in and they're saying, hey, well, we want this piece of work done, and we think that's going to take 2 days a week for 3 weeks of the month, and then nothing in the last month. Very unusual contract terms. We would hire people to fit that specific contract and bring them in on freelance arrangements. So to do that, it's very hard to, unless you have a ton of work that's going to keep lots of people busy all the time. The model of having a flexible operating model with different people on freelance arrangements was a much more profitable and much more effective way to scale. Now, that worked to start with, but as we grew and then we had bigger contracts, or we had multiple contracts from different clients, we could then put together, well, this bunch of work fits for a full-time person. And then we could start to build a team and build slowly. But I was very conservative and cautious about not overhiring, because the last thing I wanted to do was to lay people off unnecessarily.
That might be attractive. Some freelance guys may want to remain as freelance guys. They've got work elsewhere.
Yeah,
just complementing that. You might be the cash cow, if you like, but they've maybe enjoyed that, and that's an attractive reason to.
I think it was. One weird thing, that's there's a lot of freelancers out there. There's a ton of freelance writers out there, but what they probably hate doing more than anything is doing the sales and marketing and the admin around running the business.
Yeah,
they want to be freelance writers. Yeah. So the attraction for them coming to us is that we kind of do the sales and marketing for them, and they get to do the work, and we give them a steady stream of work from different clients and different types of work. So it kind of fits well for both of us.
And we talked about, did you say 2010, you're in Glasgow, you've got your commercial director down in London, you're tackling the UK, but you've since gone Singapore, Boston, Vancouver, Middle East, China. I know we've spoken about.
Yeah.
There's challenges, different cultures.
Oh, yeah.
But in terms of the regulated industry, does it differ between these markets? And could you share some of the challenges there and how you've internationalized your business?
For sure. Well, the regulations are different. The principles are largely the same, but the actual specifics about what you can and can't say, there are nuances between the different countries we operate in. The international thing came about I guess by chance. I've been, you know, I don't know if you create your own luck or have to be, you know, open-eyed to the opportunity of new ideas and innovations. But anyway, I feel there's a bit of fortune came about in that we picked up our biggest client in London. We were doing a good job for them. We were producing monthly commentaries on their mutual funds. We were bailing them out in terms of they had lots of problems trying to get this work done, and we helped them get that done efficiently, on time, on budget. And then their colleagues in New York found out about it, and they asked, well, can you help us do our reports? We have 100 a month that we need you to help out on. So we did that, and that was really the stepping stone to saying, well, let's do that from the UK to start with and see if we can make that work. But it was a disaster. Well, we got it done, but we were up till midnight most of the time for days and days every month trying to satisfy the client, until we realized we really need to actually do this properly and strategically think about how do we grow this business. So got on a plane, did all the things, set up the company in Boston, and hired someone out there to start to grow the business and use the revenue from that first US client to pay for that growth. So it was kind of accidental to start with, and I think I've written a blog about that, the accidental strategist or something. But it really was accidental to start with, and then I put some strategy around it, as you'll be happy to hear. Yeah. And think, well, okay, so there's clearly something here, so how do we organize this in a way that isn't just, you know, a shotgun random chance by how we market to companies? And we figured out where our clients do business and where their marketing budgets are and where the opportunity lay. So we decided to set up as an organization where we wanted to become the content partners for our clients, specifically investment and wealth managers, and be there wherever they're doing business, which is largely, it's New York and Boston for North America, with a few exceptions, London and Edinburgh for Europe, and then Singapore or Hong Kong for Asia. So we kind of clustered ourselves around where the clients are. Mm. Kind of makes sense, because it's where we could find our talent as well.
Yeah.
And is that, would that again, turns how people learn from what you've went through, would that be the lesson in terms of understanding market maturity, that sometimes you take the jump, or sometimes it's that coalescing of the client base?
I would certainly look at your existing clients, first of all.
Okay.
And I think that even now, and, you know, I think we've talked about our UK business being quite mature after 20 years. And it is to some extent in that we know a lot of our customers and we know a lot of the clients in the market, but there's still a lot more we could do for our customers here, whether that's developing new services for those existing customers or doing more with those existing customers. And I think looking at your existing customers first is a great way to think, you know, do they trade overseas and how could they help? How could we help each other grow together in the new markets? I think that's probably the best. It's easier to do work with existing customers than to acquire new customers, I think.
I suppose, I mean, without, we'll come on to your vision for CopyLab, but in terms of, I suppose, your purpose in terms of outsourcing or agency work, why would an investment firm choose to go to outsource those services, and what's your, I suppose, your value proposition to them?
There's various reasons they would come to us. For part of what we do, there's the regulated element, which means they have to publish certain content early, like very soon after the end of a month or a quarter. So to do that in-house, it's very difficult. If you're going to hire a bunch of people to produce 100 reports by business day 5, and do you hire those people in-house or do you outsource that work? Because if you hire them in-house, they're going to be unoccupied for a large chunk of the time. It's not efficient.
Yeah.
So there's an efficiency aspect for some of the work we do, but then there's a creative and technical knowledge that is sometimes missing in-house. The investment industry is so vast and diverse. Some companies can be selling equity funds, fixed income, private equity, ESG and sustainability, hundreds of different vehicles, it's impossible to have subject matter knowledge of all of those different things. So at the moment, for example, there's a huge demand for private equity and private credit as an investment sector. It's very hard to find people that can do that work. So increasingly, we're getting demand from customers saying, hey, we want to do a white paper on private credit in North America. Have you got people who can help us do that? And we go, yes, we can. We find it hard to find them too, but they don't want to hire those people in-house because there'll be a new trend in 2 years' time. And like ESG was huge a few years ago,
yeah,
and it's not so much anymore, particularly in North America. Let's not talk about politics.
Yeah.
But, you know, trends change. So do you really want to own a subject matter expert in-house when it might not be the flavor of the month next year?
So how do you split your time? Boston?
Mm. You're now living there.
Yeah, for the past 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Which is a great place to be. Would highly recommend a visit for anyone that wants to go there.
That's an invite, Gregor.
It is.
Hopefully I'll wait for the post.
Yeah.
It is. There's a good energy to Boston as well, isn't there, in terms of
there is
space and support?
I would say America's a continent. It's not a country. And depending on your sector and what business you're in and who you're targeting, Boston could be a great place. If you're in life sciences, fintech, and general business is pretty good, but those two industries are huge, financial services, fintech, and life sciences in particular. And then you've got, you know, Houston for energy, New York, which is very diverse, but financial services, and so on.
It's actually been slightly disruptive again. It's like the Glasgow Edinburgh.
A little question. You're right, it is. But Boston is, I see Boston is to Edinburgh as New York is to London. Like smaller, very academic, maybe a bit more quieter, easier to get around, but it still has a thriving financial community and a strong ecosystem of service providers around that that makes it attractive for us to be there too.
So that's the base. And then in terms of the customers you work with, I guess your trusted investment and communications partner.
Yep.
And then thinking about everything we've went through the last 20 minutes, half an hour, you're disruptive, but there must be a huge part of you winning jobs that's the trust element, the professionalism, and somebody knowing exactly what they're going to get from you, along with that creative part. So how do you get that proficient over to your customer base? Potential customer?
It's a good question. I think it's every B2B company has that. Yeah. And we try and help our customers do that too, because a lot of them are wealth managers or they're investment companies. They have faced the same problems. And it comes down to probably three skill sets, three attributes you want to try and communicate. It really came to the fore when we were launching in the US more strategically, which is you need brand awareness. So building awareness through what that you actually exist, is particularly in a market where like the US is very competitive. There's a lot of other companies out there trying to do what you do. So a lot of social media activity to build awareness. The second is demonstrate expertise. You need to prove yourselves to be smart. So lots of blogs and white papers and sort of thoughtful content that proves that you're authentically an expert. And the third is building trust. And trust is hard to do with someone you've not met before. But one tactic to do it is through case studies. So that could be written case studies about a piece of work you've done for a client, or a video testimonial from a client, particularly one that's got a very well-known brand name, for example, that sort of gives that stamp of authority that you know what you're doing.
It's interesting. There's a real human element to the trust word, isn't there?
Yeah, and there is. And it's not just doing the job, but it's actually bringing new clients in. We really want to get in a room with that client and build a relationship with them. We're not trying to build a SaaS model where it's all very remote, it's all very online, and marketing is important, but ultimately it's trying to build a relationship with a customer that is going to last a lifetime.
I've got a stat here that you're working with maybe more of 70% of the largest asset management companies. So we hear a lot about data. Mm. Or, you know, we've just talked about knowledge and trust. How do you leverage that bank of knowledge and data that you must have with these firms to sort of go and position yourself in a strong way to your customers?
We leave that to them. They're the data guys. We're the content guys. We use data. Our customers own their data. They own their IP. So what we're good at is working with them and their data to create stories and create content that will resonate with their customers.
So you interpret data in content for them.
Yeah. So a lot of, you know, the financial sector is about numbers.
Yeah.
Particularly when it comes to investment funds. So, and being able to interpret the numbers and put a story and narrative around that, that's a real skill set.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of your, I suppose your vision then, and your values of your business. We haven't talked much about your values and what's behind it. We've talked about your, let's say you were a trendy alternative when you first started, and you've kept that vibe going in your business. You can tell by how you market yourself. Yeah. You know, it sets the instant that you see your website, for instance, and the way you've set that up, it's very you.
I thought you meant my personal LinkedIn, which is...
We'll come to that.
I know.
You're getting absolutely out there, but we'll definitely come to that. But yeah, I mean, share a bit about the vision for the business when you started. Has that changed? And your values through your 20-year journey as well, and how you cascade that down to your employees.
Yeah, we have been kind of disruptive at the start, a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we also don't want to be too far out there because we know our clients are regulated financial services companies. So we want them to trust that we're not going to go and do crazy things with their data, with their stories and with their marketing. So there is a balance to be had. I think we have grown up over the last 5 to 10 years. When it was just me, it was a bit more chaotic, shall we say. But I've got a great team around me that knocks me into shape. They're terrified by some of the things I put on LinkedIn and going, what are you doing? Like, well, I'm just being authentically me and deal with it. Mm. But for the company itself and for the way we deal with our clients, we're a professional organization. And, you know, we've built long relationships with some of them, 10, 12, 15 years with a lot of them. So we've been able to build that trust by doing a really good job, looking after them, being thoughtful about making sure we meet their budgets, meet their deadlines. Those things are really important to our clients. And the quality's got to be up there as well. Those are not just table stakes. I think there's a lot of poor quality out there. And it's really important for us to maintain a really high level of quality, particularly in the world of AI.
Yep.
It's taken us half an hour to get to AI.
Can't believe it. I thought we'd get there in a few minutes.
We'll definitely come into that. I just wanted to sort of keep on your team, your team as well, because I first met you, Ross, remotely during COVID.
True.
And for those on the camera, Ross is about 6'4". 6'4".
We're not.
And I thought he was about 5'4". So
I think I'm shrinking in my old age.
No, in terms of your team and being remote, and how do you keep that spirit up, and do you meet up regularly and to keep that, you know, the whatever the copy lab way is, you know?
Yeah.
You've said about your customers being, you know, they aren't you respectful of them, but you still have to create an environment that people want to stay and be in, and your freelancers who can come and go, why do they stick with you? So I'm just trying to get that understanding for that and how you keep that spirit alive.
It is the hardest thing about running a remote first company. I really wanted it at the start, and that was really my passion. I hated commuting. I didn't like being forced into the office every day, and I really loved being a freelancer in those early years of CopyLab when I was doing that. So I really wanted to keep that. Even though we started an office in Glasgow and then got one in Edinburgh after that, and London, I really wanted to have that flexible working environment for my team. Because their opportunity was, well, I can work with CopyLab and have this more flexible working life for the most part, or I can go and work for the clients or competitors and work in-house. So it's important. It was a differentiator for us to have a remote first working model. But the downside of it is it's really hard to build a cohesive team when you have 30 people in 30 different locations. I wouldn't say we've mastered it completely, but what we know works is getting people together regularly. So what we've settled in on is we have a monthly cadence where the team in Edinburgh, where there's the biggest cluster, has a in-office day, and it's the last Thursday of every month. Everyone comes in and gets together, works together, spends time, and probably goes for a beer after work half the time as well. And that's actually led to that process over the past couple of years has actually led to them saying, actually, I want to spend more time in the office. So we've increased our desk count in the office in Edinburgh from 4 to, I think, 8. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing just more of a team evolving there, which is really great. And then we meet up as a company quarterly, the entire company. So last week we were in London. I flew in from Boston, along with my colleagues from New York and New Orleans. Paul came in from Asia, and Chang Yao, who's our China representative, although she lives in Manchester, came to the meeting as well. And it was a great, we do that every quarter. It's the one thing we'll not give up, because it's the great opportunity just to meet and to do some training and all the updates and stuff. But it's the valuable part is going for dinner afterwards and hanging out with people, because you just get that, you just get a bit more team bonding going. So in a month's time, when there's a problem and you're grumbling about your colleague in another part of the world, you still remember they're actually good people. They're actually decent.
And you get to know them better. You get a lot of fresh ideas sometimes when you're out of the office environment as well, don't you, and together.
Yep. So some of the wackier ideas come from the pub.
Yeah. It's interesting about the more people back up, because we've been speaking to a few now, so I've mentioned that as well.
Yeah, because my daughter's about to start an internship, and she's the runner 2 days in the office and 3 days outside the office. It's an interesting one for somebody who's going in just before she's about to do a graduate position.
Yeah,
when you're looking for that community and that spirit. So I think it's very important. And the last few companies, they're definitely saying they're building more sort of desks and offices, and they're getting together more regularly. And I suppose, I don't think I let you answer the question about how do you split your time, but you've just answered that a bit there. How do you split your time between you sound as if you're getting...
I think you're right, especially for young people. And because of the agency consultancy model, you probably end up employing older people because they're more experienced. But for a company with younger people, we found when we did have young people, we need to get them in the office because they need to learn from the older people. So that really, that's important.
Yeah, so we'll see whether that's enough time. You know,
yeah, and I do see companies, our clients, getting their people back into the office more as well. Mm-hmm. Especially the big financials who have got giant tower blocks in big cities. They're pretty expensive. So that the hybrid working is starting to evolve back into pre-pandemic full-time in-office working. Mm-hmm. I've got a friend who works in commercial property in Boston, and the rates for commercial property are a fraction of what they were pre-pandemic, probably half, but they're starting to edge back up again. This is for office property in particular, because the bigger companies are starting to push their people back in 2 to 3, 3 to 5 days a week.
Yeah, it's definitely happening all over. And we've been to a few areas where they've got the shared working space, and it's either that, or if they own their own office, they're really trying to make it a destination. So people see a worth in coming into the office, and they've got the team bonding, but they've got an environment that works and helps in terms of what they're trying to do. As I'm just to finish that off before we go to the big question. Yeah. You think about starting office by yourself again, then some of the stuff we've just went through about culture that Andy was asking about, how do you see yourself having changed over those years in terms of your leadership?
If I'm being honest, I've definitely realized what I'm good at and what I'm less good at.
Yep.
And there's two ways of dealing with your weaknesses. You can work on them or you can hire for them. And I've been in a fortunate position that I've been able to hire people that have been really great at the things that I'm less good at. So I've now got a senior team who I love working with. They're incredible at what they do, and we actually fit together really well. So being honest, my CEO, Lauren, is a great people manager. She's incredible at that, much better than I am. I'm ashamed to admit it as a founder of a services business, but she is much better at managing people than I and leading people than I am. I've got a really great commercial director in Stuart, who is very client focused, and then I've got some really amazing operations people that look after the day to day clients and making sure the quality is up there. What does that leave for me? Well, I'm definitely more of rather than a people's person, I'm a things person. So I really love working on the strategy, developing new services, partnerships, and trying to think about growing the business. And that's how I'm spending more of my time.
So that's a good segue into AI then, because you're looking at things. And I suppose it's quite a big thing for companies, for the world. It's growing at a rate of knots exponentially in terms of where it's impacting and the jobs it could impact. So for a copywriter, AI could be definitely a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And we've heard you talk about, you know, the personal touch that you might not get. So I'm interested, I'm sure we can have a few minutes in this because folk are interested in this. So how are you handling that? How are you looking at the future for CopyLab, and where do you see it impacting the rest of the business world?
It's the million-dollar question, right? And I've just come back from watching Mission Impossible 3 with my niece and nephew last night, which was about AI and how Tom Cruise saved the world from AI. Maybe that will come, I don't know. The honest answer is no one really knows. And some days I'll read something and feel like it's the end of the world is coming. Other days I'll feel like it's a whole lot of nonsense. The truth will probably be somewhere in between. And I think it depends on your business, how much it will be affected. And yeah, copywriting is definitely in the crosshairs for AI. We know that. We all use ChatGPT for certain things. I think where my business and my industry will be affected by AI will be tempered somewhat by the fact it's regulated. So it's really important to get things right when you're communicating to investors about their pension savings or marketing to them about new products. And, you know, AI does make mistakes. And even though it's getting better, we all have this sort of muscle memory of knowing that ChatGPT will tell you some nonsense now and again. So there's that basic fact checking and technical checking aspect of AI that you need a human in the loop to make sure the quality is there. So that's one part of it. But then there's that's just the basics to make sure that you're not lying to your customers and creating a breach of compliance regulations. The other part is, I think customers are buying a premium service from a wealth manager or a fund manager. I think if they're doing that, they want to hear from the fund manager. They want to hear an authentic voice from an authentic human. And maybe AI is a tool to help them do that, produce the content they're distributing to customers. But ultimately, it needs to be written in part by a human with a voice.
Yeah.
And the challenge is that AI is quite good at replicating that up to a point. Like it's okay, but you can tell that AI wrote it and it'll maybe get better. But I think it's probably going to create a polarizing effect on content, on media, where some providers of content aren't really going to care too much about whether it feels like it's AI or not. They just want to get the message out, and they will use AI for 90 to 95% of their content. There will be another group which goes completely in the opposite direction and wants to create content that is so obviously authentically human that it becomes deliberately off color a little bit, or weird, or just quirky, to ensure that the customer understands this was the human being that was involved here.
I think that, not wanting to move away from AI, but it's an interesting one. We were talking to a company out of America that was setting up offices or staff in areas of the world that sort of more cost-effective labor, put it that way.
Mm.
And there were, you know, I'm not suggesting that's the wrong thing to do, because there wasn't enough qualified people.
Yeah.
in America to do the job. So they were actually dealing with a more of an, a resource. And I suppose that's where AI can come in, and where there isn't the resource, it can actually complement to fill in for that, to allow countries to onshore sort of activities and so on. But I'm interested on that, especially from a regulated perspective. Are you seeing that creeping into your market? And, you know, you're in a lot of these other areas anyway, so you might have copywriters in those countries, but do you see that? How do you maintain your quality? And would you always say you have CopyLab, it's the technical people that are the top of that pinnacle. They can maybe get the content written, but it needs somebody with that technical nous, and that's what you're known for. So I'm maybe answering the question, but how, where do you see that journey, you know, in terms of resource and, you know, mixing in with AI and humans?
Offshoring and outsourcing has been a thing for the financial industry for a long time, and we're a beneficiary of that from the outsourcing trend for outsourcing anything that's not core to their business. And offshoring to India or the Philippines or other parts of the world has definitely been a thing. I think some of it's coming back in-house a little bit, not in a big way. There's a bit of that in America, with nearshoring to Colombia and Mexico. India is still very popular for the services companies because of, you know, good skills in IT and English language speaking. Mm-hmm. Philippines, I think, is a better location for English language. We don't really use offshoring for ourselves. We want to position ourselves as being a premium provider of native English language content. So we will stick with that. And sometimes we'll find people out there that pass our tests, that we have a person that works with us from India, and he does a great job, just as good as the rest of our people. But that's not a choice to offshore to these parts. I think what AI is a potential risk to some of that work, whether it's basic coding that's done in India or maybe some basic content creation or updates to fact sheets or these sort of mundane, repeatable things. AI is probably more of a risk to that sort of offshoring.
I know. And are you getting a lot of questions from the team at the moment on AI? Or is that just something they deal with and they're aware of?
I think there were more in the first year when, you know, we're now 2.5 years since ChatGPT was launched. The first year was definitely disruptive and chaotic and uncertain for everyone. I think that's settled down a little bit. That's not to say we're not going to have the rug pulled out from under us at some point in the future. Who knows what's going to be developed, right? We can't really predict it. I think what we can predict with some certainty is that the existing technology is going to get better. What we're not sure about is what new revolutionary technologies will splinter off from that affect some of our products and services, not just ours, but any service company. But I think my team are relaxed. The company's doing well. We're still growing. We're getting new projects in from new clients and existing clients every day. Because what we do is really hard. We want you to write an opinion piece on private credit markets in North America. Okay, great. And where's that information going to come from? Well, we want you to interview our fund manager and get the latest views and synthesize that with our other thought pieces and create something that's very specific for this market. Maybe AI can do some of that work. It can help with research for sure. But our clients it's instinctively still want a human being to do that work.
Premiums are what you've used a couple of times.
Yeah.
That's maybe an important aspect of it, the service.
Yeah.
Because I know in the last few years, some of the work I've done in the past was in the audio industry, and there was a big swing back towards analog and turntables and something you could feel during COVID.
Yeah.
And I think we are in that sort of territory at the moment. There's a weird mix of what people want, this 24/7 news. A lot of people don't like it. There's a lot of fake news.
Yep.
Huge amount of people don't appreciate that, but so many people respond to social media. So some of the things you've spoken about, human element, the knowledge, the team, the culture, and the premium service, they must be differentiators.
I think, yeah, there are. And you can see parallels in other industries like supermarkets, were a great idea, but then people didn't feel that same, had that same feeling about them. So that's why they go to the deli shop in Stockbridge or the artisan butchers or something. They want the quality and they're willing to pay twice the price for it. I think that's just it's a full circle effect of most industries go through.
I think with AI as well, again, speaking to the range of people we're speaking to, we're seeing this exponential growth. The AI product you're using today is superseded by the one tomorrow. The one wasn't as good to get better.
Yeah.
There's this race and it's so quick. Mm. But there's going to be regulation that comes in some form for AI, whether that's across the globe is another thing, but certainly in certain markets you see that, and I think it'll settle. You know, what we're hearing is that might settle down. That might be where it goes in the future. We'll have to see. But yeah. So what's your feeling just generally in AI? Do you embrace it? I mean, you said you like things. So I think it's
really fun. I enjoy using it. I personally use Perplexity for research. I think it's really great, particularly for if you want to find some information as a backup material to write something. Perplexity is great because it gives you the source documents and you can say to it, well, I only want you to source content from first-hand sources, not second or third-hand sources. So for example, if you want to find out data on the US economy, go to Bloomberg or Trading Economics, not to The Guardian, because The Guardian will use third-hand sources. So you want to get your first-hand data. So I think that's really great. And honestly, I use ChatGPT instead of Google now because it's a more conversational thing. And I think Google could be in trouble, honestly, because I think other people are using it in the same way.
Mm.
And then there's other things which are fun. I've tried, as you know, the AI photographs generators, which I fooled some people, but not all.
Can you tell the difference?
I could. I mean, I thought I looked great.
I gave Ross a little WhatsApp and said, "Now, come on, Ross, you're handsome."
There were a few people picked up on it, but
it was good though.
It was good. Yeah. It looked like Photoshop, but maybe a bit further down.
Yeah, it was a good one. Yeah.
And there was another one which we've tried.
I didn't want to be cheeky and broadcast it on LinkedIn. I did a private message.
You did, yeah. You're a nice man, like you. But they have video avatars as well. There's this website we've tried mainly just for experimental and, you know, fun purposes. But I created this video avatar of myself and showed it to the team last week. Instead of me talking, I said, right, here's this project we did with a client. And I recorded this video to show you, to tell you what we did. And I didn't tell them it was AI generated. And then halfway through, I could see most people's faces like, saying there's something up here, what's going on, and they were looking at me and laughing at me, so I could tell the people that figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were two or three people that said, I had no idea that was
amazing,
that was fake, which shocked me because it really wasn't that good. I don't think that's ready for professional consumption yet, and maybe it'll get there, but deepfake Ross is not ready for the
I prefer the real one, innit? Yeah.
So what's next then? Is it some iterative steps like in the past in terms of scaling? Is there something very different happening? Is it expansion in other countries?
Probably not other countries. I think we're comfortable with where we are. It'll be more about developing other services that our customers are looking for. We think graphic design is really huge at the moment. That seems odd to say, but for us, we've never done a lot of that, but it makes sense to partner with words, pictures.
Yep.
And so we have a really strong team of about 10 graphic designers in our roster. And it's just becoming more of a conversation point with our clients and developing services for those customers that really are interested in AI, particularly in the US. They're more receptive to not using AI to create content, but to repurpose it and leverage it. So take an article and help us with some social media content on the back of that article. And so wealth managers, they're smaller businesses. They may have 1 to 2 people working in the business. Their budgets aren't as extensive as large asset managers. They'll say to us, well, we don't want to pay. We don't have the budgets for that. but we still want to create the content. Can you help us? So we're developing a strategy for them, or a proposition for them that is more affordable, but still is achievable for our business. So we're working on that just now.
Sounds good.
So it sounds like a solid future for CopyLab, and with its finger on the pulse, if you like, of what's going on in the market.
Hopefully. Touch wood.
So I suppose, finally, looking ahead for yourself personally, Ross, where do you see yourself in the future? As I mentioned at the beginning, you're a global Scot, and you're now, I'm interested to hear more about the work that you're doing on LinkedIn, effectively as an inverted commas. Don't know whether it's influencer, but I'm interested. I'm interested to sort of hear a bit more about that. And then we're obviously working with you, so we'll come and discuss that towards it. But yeah, so where do you see? You know, you've been on this wonderful journey with CopyLab, but where's Ross Hunter going?
Yeah, I have 20 years with CopyLab, and I have a role with CopyLab, and it's important to me. But I'm enjoying doing other things as well with other companies. And having moved to North America, I was invited to become a global Scot, which is it's an honor, and it's effectively to be an ambassador for the country and to enable Scottish companies, typically through the Global Scot Network or Scottish Enterprise, to connect with me and other global Scots around the world to help them export into their countries. So there are 30 of us in Boston, in the Boston area, another 50 or so in New York, 300 across America. And we receive companies coming into the States and try and figure out who's best placed to help them with their particular challenge.
Yeah.
I find that incredibly rewarding. And just in terms of personal purpose and vision, I like to pay it forward and help the next generation of founders. Because it's easy to export, but it's also really hard to export well. It's hard. And I think having help from people that have been there, done that, is invaluable. I had that when I was starting out in Singapore and in North America. And I think I can be of use to people. And as far as the LinkedIn stuff is concerned, well, I am passionate, not about LinkedIn itself, but about communicating and trying to demonstrate a skill set around building and marketing through storytelling. And I think this is something that's going to separate, will enable some B2B companies especially to separate.
So it's personal branding almost, sort of making.
Yeah, but that's such a sucky term, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's horrible. No one likes personal branding, but it's important to have, everyone has a personal brand, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
It's how people perceive you when you're not in the room. So we all think something of you, Andy. I'm going to tell them what it is.
Not the moment.
But we all have a personal brand, and we just, it's such a, it's the wrong term, but.
What would you call it?
I don't know, your reputation or.
No.
But I suppose what I'm trying to demonstrate by, instead of just telling people what to do, by showing how I'm doing it is to be telling my stories, the things I believe in, and I'm doing it through LinkedIn because there's some great analytics there that can tell me how many people have been reading my posts, engaging with me, and then have there been any meetings or business converted on the back of it?
It's good, bad, and ugly content as well, isn't it?
So thanks very much.
No, but what I'm saying is not. you're just saying not every day is a rosy day, you know, and that's why I've noticed. And it's that's good to be show people that's the case.
I think you need to be authentic to yourself, though, and you know, some people will look at some of my stuff and go, "I wouldn't have done that," and people have said that to me. I wouldn't have shared that. You're oversharing. And well, maybe, but I'm happy with what I'm doing. And I would say to people not to share something that they don't feel comfortable doing.
And they're not you.
And they're not me. I do think, though, that what I've discovered, having really just been going hard at this for probably 6 months, is the bar is low. There's a lot of garbage on LinkedIn. A lot of stuff that's definitely being AI generated. You can tell by the rocket emojis on every other line and the M dash, the famous M dash, which as a copywriter is now being, you know, excommunicated from language, but it serves a purpose. But even if it does, I tend to take it out because people will think I'm using AI. anyway, I think there's a great opportunity for people to use LinkedIn as a way to communicate with their audiences, whether it's for their personal brand, to build their career, or to help build their businesses. I think B2B businesses hide so much behind corporate BS, frankly. They should be telling the stories of their clients, the stories of their employees, and bring to life these faceless organizations. They could do a better job of that. And I think it's something that we're trying to do, and I'm passionate about trying to encourage companies to do that, because it can separate them in a competitive market. You look at LinkedIn, and the companies will publish their latest PDF. There'll be 5 likes and 0 comments. But if the chief marketing officer publishes the same thing, it'll be 10x the outcomes. I think that's just easy. It's easy to do better than your competitors on LinkedIn. So.
What's the numbers we saw? Was it only 1% post on themselves or photos on LinkedIn?
That's
right. I think sometimes everyone thinks everyone's very active, but that's not the case, is it?
No, it seems like it.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's only 1% are active users. There's a lot of lurkers out there.
Yeah.
People are watching this. They do see it.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you only get 1,000 impressions, 10 likes and 1 comment, there's a lot of people. It's passing there.
Yeah, it's reaching a...
It's reaching them every day.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, wish you luck with that. And
thank you.
I'll hopefully continue liking the posts.
Please do, yeah.
You put out, but...
You must be proud, because business is hard. Scaling the business is hard, and you've achieved so much already. You must feel a level of what you've done, success in a way, and think it's come across. The human element's a big part of that. I think talking about yourself has come across, and we've seen that with a lot of leaders have it, that you either learn from your mistakes or you sometimes change what you need to. Recognizing where you're very good and exceptional at, and having great people around you, is also a huge skill.
Yeah, I don't know about proud. I don't really think like that. That's for other people to say, but I appreciate that. Thank you. I just like doing the work, actually, and that's something I've... People talk about work-life balance, but I like work. I like what I do. So, you know, I was at my sister this weekend, and I was up at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, working.
Yeah.
And she's like, "What are you doing, Ross? It's 7 o'clock on Saturday morning." Well, I'm just doing what I do. I like it. And I wouldn't do it if I didn't, really. I am lucky, though. I would say, rather than proud, I'm lucky to have really good people around me, particularly having gone through some hard times in various ways over the years, to feel like we've got a really strong team around me. And that just makes it a lot easier, actually. So.
Well, we're glad. I mean, coming on to Linksys, I suppose, we are building a network of C-suite partners, and we're proud to say that you're one of the first people that we spoke to, and we're looking forward to some discussions. And I suppose it's taken on from your Global Scott experience and helping and advising businesses. And we are looking to form a bit of a community. You and I were in a business group, and we took a lot from that.
Yeah.
Or I certainly did, and your presence in it. And, you know, we're just grateful that you're joining that, and we're looking forward to seeing where that will head in the future.
Well, I'm excited to be part of it, and I wish you guys all the best of luck with it. I think looks like it was a really great team you're putting together here. And I think it's a great idea to bring together some of the best in breed of different industries and skill sets that your customers can tap into when they need certain things. And I'd be excited to work with any of your customers that are thinking about coming to North America or want help with their content creation and being able to create a story and a narrative around their business. And I'm excited for how you guys grow Linksys over the coming years.
Yes, do.
Right.
And we're excited about the road ahead as well. And we agree on the work. ethic as well, don't
absolutely.
We love working.
We love it.
So
we love
that in common.
Yeah, we go with our friends and we're down the end of the table talking about business and we like football and all the sports as well. But that's it. So we're coming to the end. There's a section that we've got called Off the Cuff.
Okay, you warned me about this.
Yes, warned you there was something coming. So it's just going to be, I'll let Gregor tell you a bit about what it is and then we'll fire into it.
Well, you'll be glad we'll finish the main part then if you and we really enjoyed the chat. It's brilliant to hear more about CopyLab, but more importantly yourself. So it's off the cuff. So no big thinking about the answers. Just hear the questions and tell us what you think, okay?
Oh my God.
So I'll start off.
You go for it.
So we'll start off in Eastman. Late or fashionably early?
Early.
Mm. What's your best habit? And what's your worst habit?
Oh. Best habit. I am very disciplined. And my worst habit is, and my partner would say I'm very disciplined. I need to actually just be more spontaneous.
So it can be both, can't it?
Sorry.
It's a good answer. Okay. If you could take a day out of the week and replace it with a second Saturday, what day goes?
Probably Sunday. It's kind of a meh day to me.
That's not great, I told you.
I quite like a Sunday, though.
Well, right.
Tuesday. Anyway, the day before Monday.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah. Even from school and homework and all that side of it.
This is an interesting one. If CopyLab were a band, what genre of music would it be? Or would you be in?
Well, I don't know about that, but what came to mind, first of all, if you said not to think about it too much, which is perfect for me, probably hair metal. So when I was, one of the first concerts I ever went to, God help me for sharing this, was Whitesnake.
Oh, yeah. We like Whitesnake.
I mean, ridiculous. Yeah. Ridiculous 1980s or 1990s band. Long blonde hair. Here I go again. Here we go again. And then there was Europe and only Def Leppard, these sorts of bands. My dad took me and my sister to a Europe concert.
Yeah.
The Final Countdown, remember that came out?
Was that in Edinburgh Playhouse?
Yes.
I think I was there with you.
Oh my God. I was in the back.
I couldn't see past them. They must have been euros.
Well, I was only 15 at the time, I think, or 12 or something.
Imagine, we've both admitted that on camera.
We'll have to cut this bit.
Yeah, we'll edit that bit.
Yeah, okay then.
Right, perfection or just good enough?
Oh, I'm a perfectionist.
Zoom call or in person? You might have answered
in
it.
In person.
I think that came across with a...
Definitely.
Come to means last week. You can't beat it sometimes, can you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
What do you miss most about Scotland?
Fish and chips.
Very good. Any sauce?
Salt and vinegar,
all right.
I'm an East Coaster.
This is a question for a copywriter. What's your favourite word and what's your least favourite word?
Okay. You have to be careful with Scottish people and their words because we can be quite colourful.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I wrote something about this. What was it? I wrote a blog about this. What was the word of the day? This was really...
It wasn't a swear word, man.
It wasn't a swear word. It was about... Oh, I'm lost on that. I don't know.
Least favourite word?
I can't believe this is the question I'm struggling with the most.
Imagine, We've caught the copyright.
The problem is, just thoughtful perfectionist.
I'm a thoughtful perfectionist. And there's too many words to choose from.
That's a good answer.
That's a good one.
And most of them are rude anyway.
You must have a few least favourite words. We don't like can't, do we?
No.
Don't like no either.
I would like to argue with you, Gregor.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I think very. And like these, I think something we teach our writers and we try and remind ourselves is to take out adverbs because they're weak words. So I am very pleased to meet you. That's like, well, very is redundant. It's a redundant word. So anything with Lee or very in it is like a redundant word. So we try and take it out of our writing because it's more powerful. Just have a better adjective.
Yeah.
You don't need an adverb.
Interesting. note to sell.
Final one. Think about everything we've talked about today, your journey you've had, CopyLab. What do you love most about the business?
You know, if there's anything I am proud of, it's that we've been able to create work for so many people over a long period of time. I am proud of that, actually. It's not just the 25 to 30 people that work in the business and, you know, on staff. I do think of our freelancer team or contractors and part-time people as part of the community. I know for, you know, legal reasons, they can't really be employees or treated such, but we do think of them that way and try and think of them. And so I think if we've got 150 people working for our business, which is what we do some months, I'm really proud of that. That's a great achievement. So.
It's a good answer. That's the question's finished. You're now off the cuff.
Oh, yeah, they're now off the cuff.
It's been an absolute delight, Ross.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing all your insights into CopyLab and, you know, been part of the From Me Too podcast from Greg and I. You know, it's very much appreciated. And as I say, from a Lynx's perspective, it's not the end. We're continuing to work with you. And we'd just be great to see CopyLab continue to go from strength to strength and you enjoying your other positive distractions in the business world.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Ross.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me.